Last month, we had members of the Iraqi Resistance Coordination Commission publishing a statement suggesting that they would halt their military operations against the U.S. occupation troops in Iraq, including rocket attacks, providing that Washington does not persist in maintaining illegal presence in the Arab country. What if U.S. troops move to Kurdistan and maybe maintain their warmongering behavior against the popular mobilization forces from Kurdistan, Iraq? What options do you think that the PMU have?
Well, firstly, Iraqi Kurdistan is still part of Iraq as a country, and any withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq, it would also include Iraqi Kurdistan. Mm-hmm. Secondly, according to the Iraqi Constitution, Article 110, it is the federal government in Baghdad who are responsible for the security of Iraq. It includes the borders, the lands, and all that goes within the national security policy of the country. So withdrawal from Iraq would also mean withdrawal from the northern region of Iraq. But in case of that doesn't happen and the U.S. forces move their bases to the northern part of the country, well, the federal government in Iraq has several options in handling this issue. One of them is the budget issue, because a lot of the money for the local budget in northern Iraq comes from Baghdad. And there are probably other alternatives as well for the government. And regardless of how the government will react, the U.S. would be very foolish if they think that they are safer up there if they take any actions against the PMF or the resistance in Iraq, because certainly the bases in northern Iraq are within the fire range of the resistance forces, especially if the surprises here, which the spokesmen are hinting to, the improved weaponry will be get to use in that matter.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Firas Ali, political commentator, for joining us from Malmo to talk about the possible confrontation that might happen between the Iraqi resistance and the U.S. if the U.S. does not leave Iraq and withdraw its troops. I want to thank you for your contribution. Now, please stay tuned with us. We will talk more about Palestine in the next segment. Israeli bulldozers and diggers demolished Palestinian village of Khirbet Humsa last week, leaving 74 people, including 41 minors, homeless. An advocacy group says that more than 800 Palestinians have been left homeless by Israeli demolitions so far this year, after this single target by Israeli demolition displaced dozens in the occupied West Bank. Israel ethnically cleansing the West Bank in this following report. Ethnic cleansing is what the Israeli regime continues to do against the native Palestinians in the occupied territories. The demolition operation, which displaced dozens of Palestinian citizens in the occupied West Bank last week, was conducted under the Israeli annexation and settlement expansion schemes. Late on Tuesday, November 3rd, as the world was busy with the U.S. elections 2020, the Israeli regime's bulldozers, heavily guarded by soldiers, razed to the ground a Bedouin village in the district of Tubas in the Jordan Valley, leaving dozens of inhabitants of the village homeless, half of whom were children. The bulldozers proceeded to demolish 70 civilian properties, including storerooms and residential tents, that sheltered 11 families composed of 60 people, including 41 children. According to a report by the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, the tented homes, animal shelters, latrines, and solar panels were among the structures that had been razed in the area. The demolitions were preceded by the confiscation of several Palestinian vehicles and other possessions. The Israeli occupation soldiers also raided Palestinian homes in the area and confiscated money and precious items from local residents. Now tell me, how is this not piracy and war crimes? Tell me, how can the Palestinians stop these illegal colonial pirates when every time this happens, they turn to the international community and UN bodies to uphold their legal and moral duties in order to urgently intervene to curb Israel's ongoing crimes against the Palestinian population? This large-scale demolition confirms once again that nothing will stop Israel from maintaining its trend of confiscations and demolitions. Well, nothing except the ultimate act of revolt, a new blood of resistance that would initiate a full-fledged intifada, a new spirit of revolution like that of Hiro Maher al-Akhras, who fought for his freedom through an empty stomach leading to a victory after 103 days of hunger strike. Maher's steadfastness and commitment to struggle with his very life on the line continue to inspire all those around the world who support the Palestinian people and their cause of return and liberation and their current fight against ethnic cleansing. Now with us from Ramallah to discuss this issue is Dr. Nimr Saad, academic and political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Saad. Now, Dr. Saad, a total of 74 people were displaced, more than half of which were minors, as Israeli bulldozers and diggers demolished houses, sheds used as livestock enclosures, portable toilets, water containers, and solar panels, on top of confiscating vehicles and tractors belonging to the Palestinian residents who are now homeless in the occupied West Bank. What is the Palestinian Authority waiting for to take firm action against Israel?
Well, we know that Israel are trying to evacuate the Jordan Valley from its 46 communities, Bedouin communities, like Humsa, which happened just a few days ago. But before that, it was also Fasayel and other areas, which is subjected to the Israeli measures of evacuation. This is a kind of an ethnic cleansing in the area. Now, for the Palestinian Authority, they are trying to do something about it. But remember that this area is sea area, which is under, according to Oslo Agreement, under the Israeli jurisdiction. It means that the Palestinian Authority officially can't do anything. So it was led to some of the, let me say, organizations and popular committees who are trying to stand with Humsa and the area in general. Now they are providing them with all the equipments they needed, new tents, and try to rebuild the whole area again. But still, this is not enough. Anyway, the Palestinian Authority also is trying to contact the international community in so many ways, through the United Nations and through the embassies, in order to put this issue in front of the international community to take measures, and especially that Belgium, for instance, was the first one to protest, and they are demanding Israel to pay them, the Belgium, compensation, because the Belgium have helped this area of Humsa. However, what we are thinking now that not only the Palestinian Authority, but I think also there should be a kind of popular resistance and popular movement in the area to support the area, exactly the same like what happened in El Khan El Ahmar, when the Palestinian stayed there all day and night for a long period to prevent the demolition of that village also.
Well, Dr. Saad, by all means, what Israel is doing is falling under the aspect of ethnic cleansing again. And this is a crime punishable by international law, yet the international community, especially the UN, seems to be completely out of the picture. Why is that?
They were always out of the picture. The problem is not that they don't know what the Israelis are doing, and let alone the United Nations. What about the European Union, for instance, who had a special treaty with Israel? According to the European Union articles, they said that we deal with the countries in accordance to their human rights violation and human rights record. And they know exactly that the Israelis are violating not only the human rights, but all kind of laws, international laws in this respect. But they don't do anything at all, because by the end of the day, they have some special relationship with America, and they are more interested in these relationships and the economic relationships with America more than the human rights in Palestine, more than the international law in Palestine. So neither the United Nations nor the European Union will do anything apart from just condemnation or trying to tell the Israeli in a way or another that you shouldn't do that. But I don't think that they are going to take any measure which will be effect. In this coming week or 2 weeks from from now on the memory of the Palestinian solidarity with the Palestinian people on the 29th of November, there will be some sessions in the United Nations, and these things are going to be addressed. But unfortunately, as I said, even if they have taken resolutions in the General Assembly or even in the other circles in the United Nations, the Israelis are not going to comply. By the end of the day, the Israelis are backed by the Americans and the Americans supporting them. They will prevent any resolution by the Security Council with the veto, and they will help Israeli. And we have so many resolutions in the United Nations on the level of the General Assembly, but the Israeli not complying with these resolutions. We need more, if you like, pressure on Israel and on America and on the international community.
This brings us to a very important question here, because as you said, the wiping off of a whole community at once is extremely rare in the world except in Palestine, and it seems that Israel is making use of the fact that everyone's attention is elsewhere. It's on the U.S. Results, the U.S. elections 2020 results. But the attention of the Palestinians is there, exactly inside Palestine. How do you think the Palestinian political and resistance factions will respond to such an ethnic cleansing, especially since the UN bodies are in a different place right now?
Well, now the Palestinians are trying to do this reconciliation and to put one strategy. I believe personally, and most of the Palestinians do believe, that we need to go into our own resistance, to ourselves, to start a real resistance, not only a peaceful, as they put it always, peaceful and popular, but also all kind of resistance should be allowed to the Palestinians. We are in such a position that not only the United Nations, but the whole world community failed us. They see the violations, they see the ethnic cleansing, which is continuing since 1948 till today, and in so many different ways, but it's still there, not only in the West Bank, but also in Jerusalem, also in Golan Heights. We have to understand, and the international community have to understand, that Israel is a state of violence and also racist against everyone, and they are not going, you know, to have at any time any relationship with the Palestinian in terms of a real peace. They wanted the whole land and they want the Palestinian out. So if we come to that idea or understand this idea, then we have to change our strategies. Strategies that still thinking that we might have negotiations, peace negotiations with Israel, and now after the elections in America, maybe there will be some movement towards these negotiations. This is absolutely stupidity, if you like. Mm-hmm. We should know that what are the intentions of Israel. They are not going to take off the settlements. They are not going to stop the ethnic cleansing. They are not going to seize their measurements to ethnic cleansing and to take our land. So we need to change our strategy to a fighting strategy, to a real resistance in all levels. And to remember that in 1982, the United Nations resolution allowed Palestinian, exactly the resolution says that the Palestinians have the right to resist the occupation in any way they find it appropriate. And I think now it's appropriate to use all kind of resistance against this country, which I can't call it even a country, this bunch of gangsters who are trying to do whatever they like and nobody can stop them.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Nabil Saad from Ramallah, for giving us the clearest picture about what's going on in the occupied territories of Palestine. Thank you very much. Our solidarity with you and all the Palestinian people for their resistance towards their liberation and their return to their rightful home in Palestine. Thank you for your contribution. Now, please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to the program Back to Reality on IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Sayyid Mustafa. I'm originally from New Zealand, and I've been living here in Iran now for about 3 years, and I've been studying here in the Hawzas. Yeah. Today with me in the studio are two very lovely brothers, and I would like them to introduce themselves as well. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting. This is Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, and I'm living here for last 8 years. Right now, studying, doing my PhD in economics, Islamic economics, and right now in front of you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much for having me here. I'm Sayyid Wahid Alawi from Sweden, and I am studying a PhD in Islamic mysticism.
The topic that we have today for you is a very interesting topic, in my view, and that is about, you know, we live in a world where everyone just likes to criticize, you know, everything. They want to give you feedback about everything, right? And when it comes to religion, you see the same thing. You see people asking a lot of questions. Many times they're criticizing, you know, Islam, or not only Islam, all religions, you know. And there's so much talk about reforming religion, right? You hear all these people saying we need to reform Islam, we need to reform the Quran, we need to reform
modernize
this.
Islam.
Huh?
Modernize Islam.
We need to modernize Islam, right. So
don't shun away from the word.
Are we allowed, can we criticize religion? You know, are we allowed to criticize religion? And can we reform religion? Is this something that's possible?
First of all, there are two different things here. Can we criticize religion? Yes. Can we reform Islam? That goes back to modernism, and that has to do with modern, what we call modern Islam.
Now, when you say we can criticize religion, how, what do you mean? How can we criticize religion?
First of all, as a convert, I can tell you that the first step towards yaqeen, towards certainty, is to be in doubt. When you have doubts and you start to go for the truth, as you mentioned in every top, in every program,
right,
which is a very good sentence, you start to have doubts. When you have doubts, if you do not criticize, if you do not search for the truth, if you do not go and ask, how would you reach certainty? So the way to certainty, the way to that peak, is through doubt and through criticizing, through asking. All right, so that is something very positive. If you have something to criticize, or you are dealing with something mentally, you want to solve that issue. Mm-hmm. That does not go hand in hand with your mind, with your intellect. You want to solve it. Now you can come and reach the truth, or you might not reach the truth, depending on your background and your set of mind. Now we have a lot of modern Muslims, for example, who believe in things that are considered immorality from the Islamic perspective. Now that is something that they have to deal with. They have not reached that level where they can say, okay, this is wrong according to this and that. But then you have other people who say, no, I have reached Islam because of criticizing my own religion. So when we start to scrutinize our own religion, when we start to point finger towards ourselves, then we see some development. Then we see an increase in knowledge, and so on and so forth.
Now, if you can criticize religion, someone might say, you can also then change it, right? If you can criticize something, you're not accepting something, you're questioning it, that means that you want to change it, right? Or you, and that's what a lot of people are doing, right? What do you think of that?
Well, as brother just said, like, we can criticize. I don't agree with the point. Because in the explanation, when we are mentioning that if you bring up a doubt and then you try to find out the answer, this is something else. Criticism is basically condemning something.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? Because when we use the word criticize, basically you're condemning something. And then when you condemn this, obviously you have proofs, or maybe it's not according to your mentality or the way you want to live or your beliefs. Because, you know, when we are growing up from our childhood, we have different people around us. Mm. And they make us our beliefs. Our beliefs are depending on the people who are surrounding us. So criticizing religion, it depends. There are the, obviously, we need to see the boundaries that
but
are...
I would argue against that. That sounds very tough.
Yeah, that's fine.
So but criticizing means condemning?
Yes.
Are you sure about that?
Would you say that, you know...
You know, generally, when we talk about criticizing, when we say you can criticize, it's basically condemning. It's not the way to... I'm talking about the general people.
I gotta check the dictionary about that.
I'm talking about the general people, general public, they think like this.
No, but we were once upon a time among the general public.
In the Quran, we have the verses and the riwayats. It also talks about that to do not blindly follow something.
Right.
That is fine. But it does not mean to criticize.
What does it mean?
To do not follow blindly means if you have a belief, you need to go and you need to research. You need to basically think about it. You need to learn about it. For example,
is a dimension of that. Not follow your religion blindly. There is a part of it which has to do with criticism. Not only doing research.
You can't really say
I would not translate criticism to condemnation.
I think what you guys are trying to say is that, you know, you can't necessarily criticize religion itself, but you can criticize our understanding of religion, right? How we understand it.
Yeah,
if we misunderstood it, then we need to correct
that understanding.
The
religion itself cannot be
right?
criticized. Yes, the understanding, the ideologies that are given, the explanation that are given by the scholars, the way they interpret it, yes, we can criticize them. We can obviously have an argument on it. But religion itself, like, for example, we are Muslims. Being a Muslim, we cannot criticize Islam. When we're talking about criticizing the religion, it means you're criticizing Islam. And, for example, if I can go through the synonyms of the word criticize, I can find a fault or disapprove and condemn.
Right.
Okay. Slate, it's informal word. So
right.
these are the basic...
So you mentioned now four different words. So
I know, yes.
One of them was condemnation. Just to make it very clear, two others were fault and finding what?
Find fault in the
fault.
Religion.
Right,
okay.
That's completely
the religion
okay.
itself, the problem is, the argument is, the religion itself, the Islam itself cannot be criticized.
Right, but what
because
if,
it's a complete set, it's been sent by someone who is... the sole owner of this, you can say, the rules or Islam, okay? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala do not have any fault. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is a perfect being. He's a sole entity. It's us who are the possible being, and we have faults in ourselves. We cannot criticize Islam itself in its true meaning, but the interpretations that we have from the other scholars within the Islam, for example, do this, do that, and this is, for example, they're interpreting a verse in another way. Yes, we can criticize or we can argue on that. But religion itself being Islam, we cannot criticize it.
Right. So I think what...
Right.
Because if you
I
can criticize...
I don't really understand
so
what
I think
you mean with that sentence, criticizing Islam as a religion in itself.
So here, let me try and maybe clarify that, right?
It's not that clear for me.
So if we say that if something is perfect, right, well, you can't really come and change or criticize it. However, we do have many, I would say, misunderstandings within religion, right? We have many wrong ideologies that have come up or many wrong. Those are the things that I think...
Even that are from the people, not from Allah.
Right, but
I think
we should differentiate between two perspectives. One is from the divine. Islam is the perfect religion. But then... what I was zooming on was from the perspective of the common layman, all right? Me as an individual, I want to scrutinize and find the truth. I want to ask. I want to do my research. Then you should be allowed to criticize the religion itself and also some parts. Now, as a Muslim, you have entered religion, but then you have question marks about, for example, some jurisprudent issues. Some fiqh issues.
Right. So you're,
you
you're
are allowed to criticize there too. So it's in a vertical line with
right.
different
I think
strengths
the,
and weaknesses.
I think the issue is that you're equating criticizing to questioning, right? I think those are two different things, right? Questioning something
questioning
or asking
something.
Question is different from actually criticize normally means like you're saying to someone.
It's harsher.
No, it means like you need to correct this aspect. That's normally what criticism means, right?
Right.
It means like If I'm saying, for example,
but I mean both aspects. That was, I mean both of those definitions that you said.
You're not talking and about the divine itself.
No, the divine is set. It's fixed. Okay, that is perfect.
Well, first of all, I would say
but
why
me as a human being who wants to reach that divine, who wants to reach that truth, who wants to reach the ultimate peak, I have to be able to ask. That is one dimension of it, or even higher or harsher, criticize.
Yeah, because within Islam, let me give you
the most firmest Muslims today who were among those who criticized the most. All right?
Well, first of all,
I have some of the examples. For example, like we have in the morning prayer, we pray 2 rakat prayer. Someone can criticize. Is someone allowed to criticize this?
No,
why
that
you
is,
pray 2?
Right, that is set.
Not 4?
That is set.
Yeah.
Right.
Or that's ta'abudi. That's
right.
Being submissive. Because there is a trial for you. Allah wants, sometimes, He orders you to do something which is not according to my feelings, which is not according to my ease. I feel comfort praying, for example, 4 rakat prayer in the morning. Yeah.
No, that is a set
not doing
principle.
Two. But the answer is, that is ta'abudi, that is submissive. There is a trial for you that Allah wants to see you, whether you are submissive to Allah or not. There are many rulings like this. Islam itself is a perfect set of religion when we talk about Islam. Within the interpretations, when it comes to, for example, the jurisprudence discussions where the people has done it, not the divine discussion, Allah, it's not from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's about the ulama or the scholars. Yes, you might disagree with someone and then you can maybe criticize or re-argue on that.
Right. No, Sayyid, he went into the Sharia perspective.
Yeah.
That is correct. The Sharia perspective. There are some, the frame is there from the Sharia perspective. The 2 rak'ats and so on and so forth. So homosexuality, for example, is forbidden.
Right.
That is not something that we as a Muslim can change, even if some modern Muslims try to.
Right.
But that is unchangeable. But then you have the topic of rights. You got women rights, animal rights, whatever. You can add that. You can add more rights to it. So the limit in the Quran and the Sunnah and the Ahadith is there. The limit of this right for this individual or this and that is there. But you can add more. That is a new look, a new outlook
Why do you think people?
The principles cannot be changed.
Well, why do you think people criticize things to begin with? Why do people criticize religion to begin with? Right. I mean, for example, do you see people criticizing, you know, mountains or, you know, like nature, trees, things like that? Right.
Right.
You don't even see people criticizing, trying to reform those things. Why are people criticizing religion? What is it? You know, that's the motivation or cause behind it.
Well, that's because we have religion up to the amount of salt in the food. I just gave this example before. Like, you know, when we cook food, just to make it tasty, we add some salt.
Isn't this a hadith as well?
Yes, it is a hadith that the people there, they just try to give a color of religion to their daily life, whereas the religion should be the main part, and then their social, or you can say the other activities or the things that they follow should be according to the religious perspective. Because, you know, in the chapter 30, verse 30, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said, I have created all the humans on the same fitrah, like on my own fitrah. He has created us all equal. Okay. And when He has created us in such a way, then He expects us to go to the perfection in the same way. It's equal. Like, there is a discussion of the woman and the man equality or not. Allah has created us equally. And this equally means that you can reach to the perfection on the equal basis.
When it comes to Sharia and reform, as I said, the set is there. There are some frames. There are some fixed frames that you cannot change. Those principles, you cannot compromise on those principles. So you will not have a reformed Islam in that perspective. The principles are set. But those modern Muslims who try to reform Islam when it comes to the principles and modernize Islam, they have a deformed Islam, not a reformed Islam. So to give an example, within the Sharia, the frame is set. A minimum of rights are given. But some argue that within that frame, you can add more rights or abolish some rules depending on the intellect of the society that you are living in. but the reverse is not allowed. You're not allowed to breach the boundaries of the minimum rights which are in the script or in the Noble Quran and the Ahadith.
All right, thank you, brothers, for your insight. That was very interesting. And just to summarize, I would say, I would say people criticize religion is because of their lack of understanding of things, right? That's when you criticize or you want to reform something, especially something that's we believe to be perfect. That's when you want to criticize and change it, right? When you don't understand it. Anyway, so that's all the time we have for this episode. Please continue listening. Continue seeking the truth and answers. Fi amanillah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of Al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam Al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام ماكس المشتري فإنه أطيب للنفس وإن أعطى الجزيل، فإن المغبون في بيعه وشرائه غير محمود ولا مأجور.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, bargain with the buyer, even if he makes a generous offer, for the loser in selling or buying is neither praised nor rewarded.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find a very interesting dialogue between one of the companions of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, where the companion was asking about the rights that one Muslim has over another Muslim. And in this dialogue, we find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says to his companion, talking about the rights which Islam has legislated for one Muslim towards another Muslim. Talking about these rights, Imam al-Baqir says to his companion, if you spare no good for your Muslim brother, he will spare no good for you. And if you help your Muslim brother, he will help you. And if your Muslim brother is absent, then keep him during his absence, meaning protect him, protect his property, protect his, I don't know, his wealth, protect his honor during his absence. And if your Muslim brother is present, then visit him and respect him, for your Muslim brother is from you, and you are from him. If your Muslim brother admonishes you, then do not leave him until his hate comes to an end, his anger comes to an end. And if good befalls your Muslim brother, then thank Allah for it. And if a tribulation affects your Muslim brother, then help him. Truly, if the world were to implement these things, these simple things, but profound things, which are found in this very simple and seemingly casual conversation, this casual dialogue, which perhaps lasted only a few minutes between a companion of Imam al-Baqir and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam himself, we find so many beautiful things, meaning spare good for your brother, help your brother, if they are absent, protect their honor, protect their wealth, respect them when they are around you, because they are from you and you are from them. Very beautiful words which we find in this dialogue, which can truly change our world for the better, in this dialogue by one of the companions of Imam al-Baqir and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam himself. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Just to let you know that when you hear these fatwa from our mujtahideen, you know, people ask this question, oh, mujtahids are giving fatwa, where does it come from? Well, the fatwa in most cases, basically are based on the ahadith of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. Or even if it's not exactly from the wordings of the ahadith, it is based on the principles derived from the Quran and the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt. Actually, there is another hadith where the question was that my non-Muslim neighbor borrowed dishes from me. He had a da'wah, you know, guest, didn't have enough utensils. He took things from me. I gave him pak and clean. He used it and then he brought it back. It was in the same state. I didn't see how he used it. The Sharia simply says you assume it to be pak unless you have knowledge and ilm that it was made najis. You know, in same theme, I get questions sometimes on the phone or the email when people move to a new house. Well, now we have a new house, you know, a Hindu was living there or a Christian was living there. What do we do? Especially the question comes, do we wash the walls? You know, I have to make sure I make his life easy. You know, you don't have to go to an extent where the Sharia has not really asked you to do that. You see, it's a very simple issue. When it comes to washroom, sink, or kitchen sink, or the counters there, or the shower, or the tub, you can, you know, make it park very easily. There's no problem. And, you know, moving into a new house is better to do that. Even when it comes to the carpet, if you had not seen it becoming najis, you can assume it to be park. But if you want to be extra, you know, cautious on this issue, do ihtiyat, you can actually put it part of the deal that the carpet should be shampooed before you move in. You know, or you do it yourself. You do it twice and things should be okay. But there's no need to worry about the walls because, you know, even if the people who were living there, we assume they were najis, they are not necessarily, people do not necessarily touch the wall with wetness. And najasat only transfers from one item to the other when there is a flowing wetness in between the two items.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
The beautiful game, as they call it, was supposed to bring people from around the world together, enabling nations and races to mix on the field, playing a sport loved by all. Yet, it seems in England, the beautiful game has an ugly side. Not from the fouls committed by the players during the match, but from the very top of the governing body ruling the sport, the FA. The chief of the English Football Association, which is one of the world's oldest and most respected, has resigned after a storm ensued, following the use of language used by the boss when describing black players making their living in the English leagues. Greg Clark was forced to apologise after he used the word coloured to describe black players, a term that's derogatory in nature and highly offensive. Furthermore, he also used other discriminatory slurs against other minorities in the sport, including women. One would have imagined that the UK of all nations would have taken note of the protests sparked by the murder of George Floyd in the US, with the protests even hitting the streets of the UK in the process. Yet it seems that the banners, adverts and campaigns to stop racism in Britain are facing an impossible battle, in particular when the very highest echelons of authority are themselves racist. Football in particular is most interesting in England, with players taking to their knees before each match as a sign of respect to the Black Lives Matter protests. Yet, as one professional football describes, the only disease in the world right now that appears to be unbeatable is racism, with Raheem Sterling himself suffering horrific abuse on the pitch from racist fans. But the truth of the matter is simple. Britain has been pulling the wool over the eyes of many by claiming that racism doesn't exist in the country. However, this could not be further from the truth, as no matter how many television adverts portray mixed-race couples living together, or the government placing token black and ethnic minority ministers in seats, the fact is, Britain is racist to the core, from the top down. So how then can Britain truly put an end to this horrific discrimination, with this in mind?
It's certainly true that there have been a lot of efforts by governments, both Labour and Conservative, over the years to try to tackle the problem of racism, including in sport and especially in football. But as we saw in the case with Mr. Clark, who used a term to refer to black people, which these days is not acceptable, he very quickly was under pressure to resign and accepted that what he'd said was unacceptable. But what's happening is that in all parts of society and all companies, including sports companies, basically people are going through what's called unconscious bias training. In other words, they may not think they're racist, but they need to learn how to relate to people of different ethnicities and what sort of language to use so as not to be unintentionally racist in their behaviour.
Across the UK, the race divide is highlighted more than ever around the towns and cities of the country, with many of the poorest areas having large populations of black and ethnic minority residents living within their boundaries. This has sparked a subconsciously racist approach in the way that certain institutions deal with such minorities across Britain. For one, the police, who claim to be improving their diversity quotas, are one of the most racist institutions in the UK, with one ex-officer claiming that being a minority in the police means dealing with racism by one's own colleagues is a daily occurrence. With racism clearly an issue within police stations around Britain already being a major factor, things are even worse on the streets, with reports claiming that the Metropolitan Police in London, which is the UK's most diverse city, is more than four times more likely to use force on black people than on other races, hence cementing the point further. But such issues can be seen around the nation, with more favourable facilities being granted to white British people over ethnic minority races, ranging inequality at educational institutions, housing, medical care, social benefits, and fighting poverty, with the racism filtering top-down when it comes to how certain areas are dealt with. In spite of high-profile faces, such as Manchester United star Marcus Rashford, aiming to get the government to wake up and feed the disadvantaged proportions of the population, it's the case that the UK government and its range of institutions are simply picking and choosing who they help based not on merit and need, but on race and social class.
When the first black and Asian immigrants came to Britain in the 1950s and 1960s, they did indeed take much of the low-paid work in the public transport sector, in factories, cleaning jobs and so on, and so the communities were much poorer. Since then, there has been greater social mobility, though. We see black people and Asian people in as university professors, Mayor of London, several government ministers, though still there are a lot of BME people who are in the lower paid job.
Catch
Canada has always boasted itself about its human rights records on the international stage. Yet a recent report by Human Rights Watch says there's much to be done regarding human rights in Canada. According to the report, there remain considerable challenges to undoing decades of structural and systematic discrimination against Indigenous people in Canada.
We had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that involved the truth-telling of the residential school system several years ago, and it came out with over 200 recommendations for Canada as a whole to take action to reconcile and to remedy a lot of these issues that are contributing to these violations. And it's very, very slow going.
Inadequate access to clean, safe drinking water, federal government's reckless discrimination against Indigenous people by denying them funding for child and family services, and widespread discrimination against First Nations women and their descendants are just a few examples cited by the report.
Canada has failed to remedy its treatment against Indigenous peoples in this country for hundreds of years. It's the ongoing assault against our people in this country. It's the legacy of colonialism and Indian Act policies that are oppressive against our people, the remnants of the residential school legacy that left our people very broken.
Back in September, the world was shocked after an Indigenous was left dying in a hospital after being mocked and insulted by the medical staff. The gruesome death was a reminder of systematic racism in the Canadian society. Back in June, the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, launched by the government in 2016 to address endemic levels of violence against Indigenous women and girls, released its final report. The inquiry made 231 recommendations and concluded that acts of violence against Indigenous women and girls amount to genocide.
So in regards to the water crisis that we have, at any time in Canada, there's approximately 100 First Nations across the country that have lack of access to clean drinking water. It's so bad that just a few weeks ago, an entire First Nation community in Northern Ontario was evacuated.
The Human Rights Report also blasted Canada's government for detaining children in immigration centres. According to reports, 118 children were detained or housed in a detention centre in 2018 to 2019. The Canadian government has also been criticised for interfering in the affairs of other countries. Canada has consistently meddled in the affairs of Venezuela. It has imposed several rounds of sanctions and temporarily suspended its diplomatic operations in Caracas. In June, Canada announced sanctions against Nicaragua for its alleged human rights violations. This interventionist policy has been in line with Washington's policy against leftist governments in Latin America. The Canadian government is also under pressure to end its $15 billion arms contract with Saudi Arabia. Canada has yet to suspend existing arms sales to the Saudi-led coalition, despite policy guidelines urging close control over exports of military equipment to countries with a record of human rights violations.
And Canada should not just say, well, I'm sorry, there's commercial considerations and there's the fight against terrorism by Saudi Arabia. What has happened in Yemen is terrible in terms of human rights. And the fact that Canada would pay a penalty is not relevant when it comes to human rights. And no, Canada is one of the only countries now, apart from the United States, that hasn't done anything. Germany has suspended.
Canada is yet to release the findings of its 2018 review of military export permits to the kingdom. Canada is also under fire to hold Myanmar accountable for the genocide of Rohingya Muslims.
In a digital world where messages can be sent in an instant, it's been interesting to note just who sent their messages of congratulations to President-elect Joe Biden, and who didn't. For many world leaders, the dutiful message was sent in quick time, but for others, many questioned the rationale behind the delay. One country that has made their feelings clear from the start is the Islamic Republic of Iran, who from the offset have stated that the eventual outcome would not change Iranian foreign policy. But one message that did slip through is the Iranian president's thoughts as to the so-called JCPOA and potential of the US returning to the table. With the JCPOA being ratified by the United Nations, the deal has been written into law and is hence why President Rouhani of Iran has warned that the Americans must learn from the mistakes of their past and insist that Washington use the election of Joe Biden as president to follow a legal and legitimate path back to its international commitments. But for one of the United States' closest allies, it seems that the arrival of Joe Biden as president could spell a huge change in policy, with the Israeli regime quickly stating that Biden being able to re-enter the deal with Iran would be no easy feat. However, is this just Israel scaremongering Biden into avoiding building closer ties with Iran, which will ultimately alienate the Netanyahu and Tel Aviv regime? In fact, so worried is the Israeli regime that one Knesset lawmaker has stated that Biden's likely policies with Iran could lead to the Israeli regime entering a physical conflict with Iran over the notion of nuclear issues. However, Iran has always stated that any nuclear program that it pursues is solely intended for civilian purposes. But with West Asia being so full of fallout left behind by the Trump government, how then will Joe Biden approach the area when he comes into office? And will US foreign policy under Biden truly be designed to bridge the gaps haphazardly created by Trump?
I think what we will see regarding the Middle East is he will want to rejoin the JCPOA and become part of that again. However, the Iranian government has rightly said that the U.S. would need to make some compensation for the damage it has done in these last 2 years since Trump pulled out of it. So that will not be a smoother re-entry to the JCPOA as Biden might like to think.
Much like the Israeli regime realizing the election of Joe Biden will be a game changer for them, so too, it seems, does the UK realize that the United States may see a very different relationship with Britain when Biden comes into office, meaning that ties with Britain and the US may no longer be such a special relationship. Already, Joe Biden has warned Britain that it will be placed at the back of the queue when it comes to the job list that he's set up. Already, Biden has to somehow reunite the people of his own country before worrying about a dividing Europe, meaning that Britain may find itself in trouble come January. With Boris Johnson already struggling to secure a deal with the EU and now facing the prospect of having nothing to grasp onto in the US, could the election of Biden spell bad news for Boris? For one, Biden is already fuming at the so-called internal market bill, which could upset the Good Friday Agreement, a topic close to the heart of the Catholic and Irish descendant president-elect Joe Biden. But Johnson's already starting to suffer defeats at home, as the House of Lords have already waved away his internal market bill, much to his embarrassment. It seems that the British have also fallen on bad times with the Brexit deal so far failing, and Biden unlikely to prop up the blundering mistakes of Boris Johnson, which could leave the British very much isolated and very much in economic and political pain. But with many nations around the world planning and preparing for a post-Trump era and promises of a new start with Joe Biden, is it simply just too soon to decide just how each nation wishes to interact with the US, reminding us all not to count our chickens before they hatch?
Yes, it is early for leaders of other countries to be approaching Biden, president-elect, and talking about trade deals and so on. However, I think people are so anxious to deal with someone who will be at least reasonable that they are reaching out now, even though it is early, and Biden will not be inaugurated for another 2.5 months.
Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden has been declared the winner of the bitterly divisive U.S. election, denying President Donald Trump a second term in the White House. Several U.S. news networks, including the Associated Press, CNN, and Fox News made the call after Biden increased his lead in the battleground state of Pennsylvania, with vote counting still ongoing in several states. His win in Pennsylvania gave him enough electoral votes needed to enter the White House. His supporters poured into the streets in front of the White House in Washington, D.C. and several other cities across the country to celebrate the victory. However, the election results represent a widening rift in the American society. Even though Joe Biden received over 75 million votes, breaking the record for more popular votes than any other president in U.S. history, President Donald Trump managed to garner more